why your journey had been planned thus. But, said Andrea, if my father had met me, I doubt if he would have recognized me. I must be somewhat altered since he last saw me. Oh, the voice of nature, said Monte Cristo. True, interrupted the young man. I had not looked upon it in that point of view. Now, replied Monte Cristo, there is only one source of uneasiness left in your father's mind, which is this. He is anxious to know how you have been employed during your long absence from him, how you have been treated by your persecutors, and if they have conducted themselves towards you with all the deference due to your rank. Finally, he is anxious to see if you have been fortunate enough to escape the bad moral influence to which you have been exposed, and which is infinitely more to be dreaded than any physical suffering. He wishes to discover if the fine abilities with which nature had endowed you have been weakened by want of culture, and in short, whether you consider yourself capable of resuming and retaining in the world the high position to which your rank entitles you. Sir, exclaimed the young man, quite astounded, I hope no false report. As for myself, I first heard you spoken of by my friend Wilmore, the philanthropist. I believe he found you in some unpleasant position, but do not know of what nature, for I did not ask, not being inquisitive. Your misfortunes engaged his sympathies, so you see you must have been interesting. He told me that he was anxious to restore you to the position which you had lost, and that he would seek your father until he found him. He did seek, and has found him, apparently, since he is here now. And finally, my friend apprised me of your coming, and gave me a few other instructions relative to your future fortune. I am quite aware that my friend Wilmore is an original, but he is sincere, and as rich as a gold mine. Consequently, he may indulge his eccentricities without any fear of their ruining him, and I have promised to adhere to his instructions. Now, sir, pray do not be offended at the question I am about to put to you, as it comes in the way of my duty as your patron. I would wish to know if the misfortunes which have happened to you, misfortunes entirely beyond your control, and which in no degree diminish my regard for you, I would wish to know if they have not, in some measure, contributed to render you a stranger to the world in which your fortune and your name entitle you to make a conspicuous figure. Sir, returned the young man with a reassurance of manner, make your mind easy on this score. Those who took me from my father, and who always intended sooner or later to sell me again to my original proprietor, as they have now done, calculated that in order to make the most of their bargain, it would be politic to leave me in possession of all my personal and hereditary worth, and even to increase the value if possible. I have, therefore, received a very good education, and have been treated by these kidnappers very much as the slaves were treated in Asia Minor, whose masters made them grammarians, doctors, and philosophers, in order that they might fetch a higher price in the Roman market. Monte Cristo smiled with satisfaction. It appeared as if he had not expected so much from Monsieur Andrea Cavalcanti. Besides, continued the young man, if there did appear some defect in education or offence against the established forms of etiquette, I suppose they would be excused in consideration of the misfortunes which accompanied my birth and followed me through my youth. Well, said Monte Cristo in an indifferent tone, you will do as you please, Count, for you are the master of your own actions and are the person most concerned in the matter. But if I were you, I would not divulge a word of all these adventures. Your history is quite a romance, and the world, which delights in romances contained in two covers of yellow paper, strangely mistrusts those which are bound in living parchment, even though they be gilded like yourself. This is the kind of difficulty which I wished to represent to you, Monsieur le Comte. You would hardly have recited your touching history than it would go forth to the world and be deemed unlikely and unnatural. You would be no longer a lost child found, but you would be looked upon as an upstart who had sprung up like a mushroom in the night. You might excite a little curiosity, but it is not everyone who likes to be made the center of observation and the subject of unpleasant remark. I agree with you, Monsieur le Comte, said the young man, turning pale, and in spite of himself trembling beneath the scrutinizing look of his companion. Such consequences would be extremely unpleasant. Nevertheless, you must not exaggerate the evil, said Monte Cristo, or by endeavouring to avoid one fault, you will fall into another. You must resolve upon one simple and single line of conduct, and for a man of your intelligence, this plan is as easy as it is necessary. You must form honourable friendships, and by that means counteract the prejudice which may attach to the obscurity of your former life. Andrea visibly changed countenance. I would offer myself as your surety and friendly adviser, said Monte Cristo, did I not possess a moral distrust of my best friends, and a sort of inclination to lead others to doubt them too. Therefore, in departing from this rule, I should, as the actors say, be playing a part quite out of my line, and should therefore run the risk of being hissed, which would be an act of folly. However, Monsieur le Comte, said Andrea, in consideration of Lord Wilmore, by whom I was recommended to you, yes, certainly, interrupted Monte Cristo, but Lord Wilmore did not omit to inform me, my dear Monsieur Andrea, that the season of your youth was rather a stormy one. Ah, said the Count, watching Andrea's countenance, I do not demand any confession from you. It is precisely to avoid that necessity that your father was sent for from Lucca. You shall soon see him. He is a little stiff and pompous in his manner, and he is disfigured by his uniform, but when it becomes known that he is in the Austrian service, all that will be pardoned. We are not generally very severe with the Austrians. In short, you will find your father a very presentable person, I assure you. Ah, sir, you have given me confidence. It is so long since we were separated that I have not the least remembrance of him. And besides, you know that in the eyes of the world, a large fortune covers all defects. He is a millionaire. His income is 500,000 francs. Then, said the young man with anxiety, I shall be sure to be placed in an agreeable position. One of the most agreeable possible, my dear sir. He will allow you an income of 50,000 livres per annum during the whole time of your stay in Paris. Then in that case, I shall always choose to remain there. You cannot control circumstances, my dear sir. Man proposes, and God disposes. Andrea sighed. But, said he, so long as I do remain in Paris and nothing forces me to quit it, do you mean to tell me that I may rely on receiving the sum you just now mentioned to me? You may. Shall I receive it from my father? Asked Andrea with some uneasiness. Yes, you will receive it from your father personally, but Lord Wilmore will be the security for the money. He has, at the request of your father, opened an account of 5,000 francs a month at Monsieur Danglars, which is one of the safest banks in Paris. And does my father mean to remain long in Paris? Asked Andrea. Only a few days, replied Monte Cristo. His service does not allow him to absent himself more than 2 or 3 weeks together. Ah, my dear father, exclaimed Andrea, evidently charmed with the idea of his speedy departure. Therefore, said Monte Cristo, feigning to mistake his meaning, therefore I will not for another instant retard the pleasure of your meeting. Are you prepared to embrace your worthy father? I hope you do not doubt it. Go then into the drawing-room, my young friend, where you will find your father awaiting you. Andrea made a low bow to the Count and entered the adjoining room. Monte Cristo watched him till he disappeared, and then touched a spring made to look like a picture, which, in sliding partially from the frame, discovered to view a small interstice which was so cleverly contrived that it revealed all that was passing in the drawing-room, now occupied by Cavalcanti and Andrea. The young man closed the door behind him and advanced towards the major, who had risen when he heard steps approaching him. "Ah, my dear father," said Andrea in a loud voice, in order that the Count might hear him in the next room. "Is it really you?" "How do you do, my dear son?" said the Major gravely. "After so many years of painful separation," said Andrea in the same tone of voice and glancing towards the door, "what a happiness it is to meet again! indeed it is, after so long a separation. Will you not embrace me, sir? Said Andrea. If you wish it, my son, said the major, and the two men embraced each other after the fashion of actors on the stage, that is to say, each rested his head on the other's shoulder. Then we are once more reunited? Said Andrea. Once more, replied the major. Never more to be separated? Why, as to that, I think, my dear son, you must be by this time so accustomed to France as to look upon it almost as a second country. The fact is, said the young man, that I should be exceedingly grieved to leave it. As for me, you must know I cannot possibly live out of Lucca. Therefore, I shall return to Italy as soon as I can. But before you leave France, my dear father, I hope you will put me in possession of the documents which will be necessary to prove my descent. Certainly, I am come expressly on that account. It has cost me much trouble to find you, but I had resolved on giving them into your hands, and if I had to recommence my search, it would occupy all the few remaining years of my life. Where are these papers, then? Here they are. Andrea seized the certificate of his father's marriage and his own baptismal register, and after having opened them with all the eagerness which might be expected under the circumstances, he read them with a facility which proved that he was accustomed to similar documents, and with an expression which plainly denoted an unusual interest in the contents. When he had perused the documents, an indefinable expression of pleasure lighted up his countenance, and looking at the major with a most peculiar smile, he said, in very excellent Tuscan, "Then there is no longer any such thing in Italy as being condemned to the galleys." The major drew himself up to his full height. "Why, what do you mean by that question?" "I mean that if there were, it would be impossible to draw up with impunity two such deeds as these. In France, my dear sir, half such a piece of effrontery as that would cause you to be quickly dispatched to Toulon for 5 years for change of air." "Will you be good enough to explain your meaning?" said the major, endeavouring as much as possible to assume an air of the greatest majesty. "My dear Monsieur Cavalcanti," said Andrea, taking the major by the arm in a confidential manner, "how much are you paid for being my father?" The major was about to speak, when Andrea continued in a low voice, "Nonsense. I am going to set you an example of confidence. They give me 50,000 francs a year to be your son. Consequently, you can understand that it is not at all likely I shall ever deny my parent." The major looked anxiously around him. "Make yourself easy. We are quite alone," said Andrea. "Besides, we are conversing in Italian." "Well, then," replied the major, "they paid me 50,000 francs down." "Monsieur Cavalcanti," said Andrea, "do you believe in fairy tales?" "I used not to do so, but I really feel now almost obliged to have faith in them." "You have then been induced to alter your opinion? You have had some proofs of their truth?" The major drew from his pocket a handful of gold. "Most palpable proofs," said he, "as you may perceive." "You think, then, that I may rely on the Count's promises?" "Certainly I do. You are sure he will keep his word with me?" "To the letter. But at the same time, remember, we must continue to play our respective parts, I as a tender father, and I as a dutiful son, as they choose that I shall be descended from you." "Whom do you mean by they?" "Ma foi, I can hardly tell, but I was alluding to those who wrote the letter. You received one, did you not?" "Yes." "From whom?" "From a certain Abbé Busoni." "Have you any knowledge of him?" "No, I have never seen him." "What did he say in the letter?" "You will promise not to betray me. Rest assured of that. You well know that our interests are the same." "Then read for yourself." And the major gave a letter into the young man's hand. Andrea read in a low voice. "You are poor. A miserable old age awaits you. Would you like to become rich or at least independent? Set out immediately for Paris and demand of the Count of Monte Cristo, Avenue de Champs-Élysées, number 30, the son whom you had by the Marquise Corsinari and who was taken from you at 5 years of age. This son is named Andrea Cavalcanti. In order that you may not doubt the kind intention of the writer of this letter, you will find enclosed an order for 2,400 francs, payable in Florence at the house of Monsieur Gozzi. Also, a letter of introduction to Monsieur le Comte de Monte Cristo, on whom I give you a draft for 48,000 francs. Remember to go to the Count on the 26th of May at 7 o'clock in the evening. Signed, Abbe Busoni. It is the same.
What do you mean? Said the Major.
I was going to say that I received a letter almost to the same effect.
From the Abbe Busoni?
No, from an Englishman called Lord Wilmore, who takes the name of Sinbad the Sailor,
and of whom you have no more knowledge than I of the Abbe Busoni.
You are mistaken. There I am in advance of you.
You have seen him, then?
Yes, once.
Where?
Ah, that is just what I cannot tell you. If I did, I should make you as wise as myself, which it is not my intention to do.
And what did the letter contain?
Read it.
You are poor, and your future prospects are dark and gloomy. Do you wish for a name? Should you like to be rich and your own master?
Ma foi, said the young man. Was it possible there could be two answers to such a question?
Take the post chaise, which you will find waiting at the Porte de Gênes as you enter Nice. Pass through Turin, Chambéry, and Pont de Beauvoisin. Go up to the Count of Monte Cristo, Avenue de Champs-Élysées, on the 26th of May at 7 o'clock in the evening, and demand of him your father. You are the son of the Marquis Cavalcanti and the Marquise Oliva Corsinari. The Marquis will give you some papers which will certify this fact and authorize you to appear under that name in the Parisian world. As to your rank, an annual income of 50,000 livres will enable you to support it admirably. I enclose a draft for 5,000 livres, payable on Monsieur Ferrier, banker at Nice, and also a letter of introduction to the Count of Monte Cristo, whom I have directed to supply all your wants. Sinbad the Sailor.
Humph, said the Major.
Very good. You have seen the Count, you say.
I have only just left him.
And has he conformed to all which the letter specified?
He has.
Do you understand it?
Not in the least.
There is a dupe somewhere.
At all events, it is neither you nor I.
Certainly not.
Well, then,
why, it does not much concern us.
Do you think it does?
No.
I agree with you there. We must play the game to the end and consent to be blindfold. Monte Cristo chose this moment for re-entering the drawing-room. On hearing the sound of his footsteps, the two men threw themselves in each other's arms, and in the midst of this embrace, the Count entered.
"Well, Marquis," said Monte Cristo, "you appear to be in no way disappointed in the son whom your good fortune has restored to you."
"Ah, Monsieur le Comte, I am overwhelmed with delight."
"There is only one thing which grieves me," observed the Major, "and that is the necessity there is for my leaving Paris so soon."
"Ah, my dear Monsieur Cavalcanti, I trust you will not leave before I have had the honour of presenting you to some of my friends."
"I am at your service, sir," replied the Major.
"Now, sir," said Monte Cristo, addressing Andrea, "make your confession."
"To whom?"
tell Monsieur Cavalcanti something of the state of your finances. Ma foi, Monsieur le Comte, you have touched upon a tender chord. Do you hear what he says, Major?
Certainly I do. But what would you have me do? Said the Major.
You should furnish him with some money, of course, replied Monte Cristo.
I?
Yes, you, said the Count, at the same time advancing towards Andrea and slipping a packet of banknotes into the young man's hand. What is this?
It is from your father. He deputes me to give you this.
Am I to consider this as part of my income on account?
No, it is for the first expenses of your settling in Paris.
Ah, how good my dear father is!
Silence, said Monte Cristo. He does not wish you to know that it comes from him.
I fully appreciate his delicacy, said Andrea.
And now, gentlemen, I wish you good morning, said Monte Cristo.
And when shall we have the honour of seeing you again, Monsieur le Comte? Asked Cavalcanti.
Ah, said Andrea, when may we hope for that pleasure?
On Saturday, if you will.
Yes, let me see. Saturday I am to dine at my country house at Auteuil on that day, Rue La Fontaine, number 28. Several persons are invited, and amongst others Monsieur Danglars, your banker. I will introduce you to him, for it will be necessary he should know you, as he is to pay your money.
Full dress? Said the Major, half aloud.
Oh, yes, certainly, said the Count. Uniform, cross, etc., etc.
And how shall I be dressed? Demanded Andrea.
Oh, very simply. Black trousers, polished boots, white waistcoat, either a black or blue coat, and a long cravat. Go to Blin or Veronique for your address. Batistan will tell you where they live if you do not know where to address them. The less pretension there is in your dress, the better will be the effect, as you are a rich man. If you mean to buy any horses, get them of Devadeur, and if you purchase a phaeton, go to Baptiste for it.
At what hour shall we come? Asked the young man.
About 6:30.
We will be with you at that time, said the Major.
The two Cavalcanti bowed to the Count and left the house. Monte Cristo went to the window and saw them crossing the street arm in arm.
There go two miscreants, said he. It is a pity they are not really related.
Then, after an instant of gloomy reflection, come, I will go to see the Morels, said he. I think that disgust is even more sickening than hatred. 58. At the Gate. Our readers must now allow us to transport them again to the enclosure surrounding Monsieur de Villefort's house, and behind the gate, half screened from view by the large chestnut trees which on all sides spread their luxuriant branches, we shall find some persons of our acquaintance. This time Maximilian was the first to arrive. He was intently watching for a shadow to appear amongst the trees, and awaiting with anxiety the sound of a light step on the gravel walk. At length the long-desired sound was heard, and instead of one figure as he had expected, he perceived that two were approaching him. The delay had been occasioned by a visit from Madame Danglars and Eugénie, which had been prolonged beyond the time at which Valentine was expected. That she might not appear to fail in her promise to Maximilian, she proposed to Mademoiselle Danglars that they should take a walk in the garden, being anxious to show that the delay, which was doubtless a cause of vexation to him, was not occasioned by any neglect on her part. The young man, with the intuitive perception of a lover, quickly understood the circumstances in which she was involuntarily placed, and he was comforted. Besides, although she avoided coming within speaking distance, Valentine arranged so that Maximilian could see her pass and repass, and each time she did so, she managed, unperceived by her companion, to cast an expressive look at the young man, which seemed to say, "Have patience, you see, it is not my fault." In the space of about 30 minutes, the ladies retired, and Maximilian understood that Mademoiselle Danglars' visit had at last come to a conclusion. In a few minutes, Valentine re-entered the garden alone. For fear that anyone should be observing her return, she walked slowly, and instead of immediately directing her steps towards the gate, she seated herself on a bank, and carefully casting her eyes around to convince herself that she was not watched, she presently rose and proceeded quickly to join Maximilian. "Good evening, Valentine," said a well-known voice. "Good evening, Maximilian. I know I have kept you waiting, but you saw the cause of my delay. Yes, I recognize Mademoiselle Danglars. I was not aware that you were so intimate with her." "Who told you we were intimate, Maximilian?" "No one, but you appeared to be so. From the manner in which you walked and talked together, one would have thought you were two schoolgirls telling your secrets to each other." "We were having a confidential conversation," returned Valentine. "She was owning to me her repugnance to the marriage with Monsieur de Morcerf, and I, on the other hand, was confessing to her how wretched it made me to think of marrying Monsieur d'Epernay." "Dear Valentine, that will account to you for the unreserved manner which you observed between me and Eugénie, as in speaking of the man whom I could not love, my thoughts involuntarily reverted to him on whom my affections were fixed." "Ah, how good you are to say so, Valentine. You possess a quality which can never belong to Mademoiselle Danglars. It is that indefinable charm which is to a woman what perfume is to the flower and flavor to the fruit, for the beauty of either is not the only quality we seek. It is your love which makes you look upon everything in that light. No, Valentine, I assure you such is not the case. I was observing you both when you were walking in the garden, and on my honor, without at all wishing to depreciate the beauty of Mademoiselle Danglars, I cannot understand how any man can really love her. The fact is, Maximilian, that I was there, and my presence had the effect of rendering you unjust in your comparison. No. But tell me, it is a question of simple curiosity. Does Mademoiselle Danglars object to this marriage with Monsieur de Morcerf on account of loving another? I told you, I was not on terms of strict intimacy with Eugénie. Yes, but girls tell each other secrets without being particularly intimate. Oh, now that you did question her on the subject. Ah, I see you are smiling. If you are already aware of the conversation that passed, the wooden partition which interposed between us and you has proved but a slight security. Come, what did she say?
She told me that she loved no one, said Valentine, that she disliked the idea of being married, that she would infinitely prefer leading an independent and unfettered life, and that she almost wished her father might lose his fortune, that she might become an artist, like her friend Mademoiselle Louise d'Army.
Ah, you see? Well, what does that prove? Asked Valentine.
Nothing, replied Maximilian.
Then why did you smile?
Why, you yourself had your eyes fixed on me.
Do you wish me to go?
Ah, no, no. But do not let us lose time. You are the subject on which I would wish to speak.
True, we must be quick, for we have scarcely 10 minutes more to pass together.
Ma foi, said Maximilian in consternation.
Yes, you are right. I am but a poor friend to you. What a life I cause you to lead, poor Maximilian, you who are so formed for happiness. I bitterly reproach myself, I assure you.
Well, what does it signify, Valentine, so long as I am satisfied, and feel that even this long and painful suspense is amply repaid by 5 minutes of your society, or 2 words from your mouth? And I have also a deep conviction that heaven would not have created 2 hearts harmonizing as ours do, and restored us to each other almost miraculously, at last to separate us.
Thank you for your kind and cheering words. You must hope for us both, Maximilian, for I am almost incapable of realizing the feeling. But why must you leave me so soon? I do not know particulars. I can only tell you that Madame de Villefort sent to request my presence, as she had a communication to make on which a part of my fortune depended. Let them take my fortune. I am already too rich, and perhaps when they have taken it, they will leave me in peace and quietness. You would love me as much if I were poor, would you not, Maximilian?
Oh, I shall always love you.
What should I care for either riches or poverty if my Valentine was near me, and I felt certain that no one could deprive me of her? But do you not fear that this communication may relate to your marriage?
I do not think that is the case. however it may be, Valentine, I protest to you that I will never love another. And do you think it makes me happy to hear such a protestation?
Pardon me, I did not mean to grieve you. But I was going to tell you that I met Monsieur de Morcerf the other day, and he told me he had received a letter from France, announcing his immediate return.
Valentine turned pale and leaned against the gate for support.
Can it really be true? And is that why Madame de Villefort has sent for me?
No, that cannot be the case, for the communication would not be likely to come through her instrumentality.
Why not?
Because, I scarcely know why, but it has appeared as if Madame de Villefort secretly objected to the marriage, although she did not choose openly to oppose it.
Is it so? Then I feel as if I could adore Madame de Villefort.
Do not be in such a hurry to do that, said Valentine, with a sad smile. If she objects to your marrying Monsieur d'Epernay, she would be all the more likely to listen to any other proposition.
No, Maximilian, it is not suitors to which Madame de Villefort objects. It is marriage itself.
Marriage? If she dislikes that so much, why did she ever marry herself?
You do not understand me, Maximilian. About a year ago, I talked of retiring to a convent. Madame de Villefort, in spite of all the remarks which she considered it her duty to make, secretly approved of the proposition. My father consented to it at her instigation, and it was only on account of my poor grandfather that I finally abandoned the project. You can form no idea of the expression of that old man's eye when he looks at me, the only person in the world whom he loves, and, I had almost said, by whom he is beloved in return. When he learned my resolution, I shall never forget the reproachful look which he cast on me, and the tears of utter despair which chased each other down his lifeless cheeks. Ah, Maximilian, I experienced at that moment such remorse for my intention that, throwing myself at his feet, I exclaimed, "Forgive me, pray forgive me, my dear grandfather. They may do what they will with me. I will never leave you." When I had ceased speaking, he thankfully raised his eyes to heaven, but without uttering a word. Ah, Maximilian, I may have much to suffer, but I feel as if my grandfather's look at that moment would more than compensate for all.
Dear Valentine, you are a perfect angel, and I am sure I do not know what I can have done to merit your being revealed to me. But tell me what interest Madame de Villefort can have in your remaining unmarried. Did I not tell you just now that I was rich, Maximilian, too rich? I possess nearly 50,000 livres in right of my mother. My grandfather and my grandmother, the Marquis and Marquise de Saint-Marin, will leave me as much more, and Monsieur Noirtier evidently intends making me his heir. My brother Edouard, who inherits nothing from his mother, will therefore be poor in comparison with me. Now, if I had taken the veil, all this fortune would have descended to my father and, in reversion, to his son.
Ah, how strange it seems that such a young and beautiful woman should be so avaricious. It is not for herself that she is so, but for her son. And what you regard as a vice becomes almost a virtue when looked at in the light of maternal love.
But could you not compromise matters and give up a portion of your fortune to her son?
How could I make such a proposition, especially to a woman who always professes to be so entirely disinterested?
Valentine, I have always regarded our love in the light of something sacred. Consequently, I have covered it with the veil of respect and hid it in the inmost recesses of my soul. No human being, not even my sister, is aware of its existence.
Valentine, will you permit me to make a confidant of a friend and reveal to him the love I bear you?
Valentine started.
A friend, Maximilian? And who is this friend? I tremble to give my permission.
Listen, Valentine. Have you never experienced for anyone that sudden and irresistible sympathy which made you feel as if the object of it had been your old and familiar friend, though in reality it was the first time you had ever met? Nay, further, have you never endeavoured to recall the time, place, and circumstances of your former intercourse, and failing in this attempt, have almost believed that your spirits must have held converse with each other in some state of being anterior to the present, and that you are only now occupied in a reminiscence of the past? Yes. Well, that is precisely the feeling which I experienced when I first saw that extraordinary man. Extraordinary, did you say?
Yes. You have known him for some time, then? Scarcely longer than 8 or 10 days. And do you call a man your friend, whom you have only known for 8 or 10 days? Ah, Maximilian, I had hoped you set a higher value on the title of friend. Your logic is most powerful, Valentine. But say what you will, I can never renounce the sentiment which has instinctively taken possession of my mind. I feel as if it was ordained that this man should be associated with all the good which the future may have in store for me, and sometimes it really seems as if his eye was able to see what was to come, and his hand endowed with the power of directing events according to his own will. He must be a prophet, then, said Valentine, smiling. Indeed, said Maximilian, I have often been almost tempted to attribute to him the gift of prophecy. At all events, he has a wonderful power of foretelling any future good.
Ah, said Valentine in a mournful tone, do not let me see this man, Maximilian. He may tell me whether I shall ever be loved sufficiently to make amends for all I have suffered. My poor girl, you know him already.
I know him? Yes. It was he who saved the life of your stepmother and her son.
The Count of Monte Cristo?
The same.
Ah, cried Valentine, he is too much the friend of Madame de Villefort ever to be mine.
The friend of Madame de Villefort?
It cannot be. Surely, Valentine, you are mistaken. No, indeed I am not, for I assure you, his power over our household is almost unlimited. Courted by my stepmother, who regards him as the epitome of human wisdom, admired by my father, who says he has never before heard such sublime ideas so eloquently expressed, idolized by Edouard, who, notwithstanding his fear of the Count's large black eyes, runs to meet him the moment he arrives and opens his hand, in which he is sure to find some delightful present. Monsieur de Monte Cristo appears to exert a mysterious and almost uncontrollable influence over all the members of our family.
If such be the case, my dear Valentine, you must yourself have felt, or at all events will soon feel, the effects of his presence. He meets Albert de Morcerf in Italy. It is to rescue him from the hands of the banditti. He introduces himself to Madame Danglars. It is that he may give her a royal present. Your stepmother and her son pass before his door. It is that his Nubian may save them from destruction.
This man evidently possesses the power of influencing events both as regards men and things. I never saw more simple tastes united to greater magnificence. His smile is so sweet when he addresses me that I forget it can ever be bitter to others. Ah, Valentine, tell me if he ever looked on you with one of those sweet smiles. If so, depend on it, you will be happy.
Me? Said the young girl. He never even glances at me. On the contrary, if I accidentally cross his path, he appears rather to avoid me.
Ah, he is not generous, neither does he possess that supernatural penetration which you attribute to him, for if he had, he would have perceived that I was unhappy. And if he had been generous, seeing me sad and solitary, he would have used his influence to my advantage. And since, as you say, he resembles the sun, he would have warmed my heart with one of his life-giving rays.
You say he loves you, Maximilian. How do you know that he does? All would pay deference to an officer like you, with a fierce moustache and a long sabre, but they think they may crush a poor weeping girl with impunity.
Ah, Valentine, I assure you, you are mistaken. If it were otherwise, if he treated me diplomatically, that is to say, like a man who wishes by some means or other to obtain a footing in the house so that he may ultimately gain the power of dictating to its occupants, he would, if it had been but once, have honored me with the smile which you extol so loudly. But no. He saw that I was unhappy, he understood that I could be of no use to him, and therefore paid me no regard whatever. Who knows but that in order to please Madame de Villefort and my father, he may not persecute me by every means in his power. It is not just that he should despise me thus without any reason for so doing. Ah, forgive me, said Valentine, perceiving the effect which her words were producing on Maximilian. I have done wrong, for I have given utterance to thoughts concerning that man which I did not even know existed in my heart. I do not deny the influence of which you speak, or that I have not myself experienced it, but with me it has been productive of evil rather than good. Well, Valentine, said Morel with a sigh, we will not discuss the matter further. I will not make a confidant of him. Alas, said Valentine, I see that I have given you pain. I can only say how sincerely I ask pardon for having grieved you. But indeed I am not prejudiced beyond the power of conviction. Tell me what this Count of Monte Cristo has done for you. I own that your question embarrasses me, Valentine, for I cannot say that the Count has rendered me any ostensible service. Still, as I have already told you, I have an instinctive affection for him, the source of which I cannot explain to you. Has the sun done anything for me? No, he warms me with his rays, and it is by his light that I see you, nothing more. Has such and such a perfume done anything for me? No, its odor charms one of my senses, that is all I can say when I am asked why I praise it. My friendship for him is as strange and unaccountable as his for me. A secret voice seems to whisper to me that there must be something more than chance in this unexpected reciprocity of friendship. In his most simple actions, as well as in his most secret thoughts, I find a relation to my own. You will, perhaps, smile at me when I tell you that ever since I have known this man, I have involuntarily entertained the idea that all the good fortune which has befallen me originated from him. However, I have managed to live 30 years without this protection, you will say, but I will endeavour a little to illustrate my meaning. He invited me to dine with him on Saturday, which was a very natural thing for him to do. Well, what have I learnt since? That your mother and Monsieur de Villefort are both coming to this dinner. I shall meet them there, and who knows what future advantages may result from the interview. This may appear to you to be no unusual combination of circumstances. Nevertheless, I perceive some hidden plot in the arrangement, something, in fact, more than is apparent on a casual view of the subject. I believe that this singular man, who appears to fathom the motives of everyone, has purposely arranged for me to meet Monsieur and Madame de Villefort, and sometimes, I confess, I have gone so far as to try to read in his eyes whether he was in possession of the secret of our love. My good friend, said Valentine, I should take you for a visionary, and should tremble for your reason if I were always to hear you talk in a strain similar to this. Is it possible that you can see anything more than the merest chance in this meeting? Pray reflect a little. My father, who never goes out, has several times been on the point of refusing this invitation. Madame de Villefort, on the contrary, is burning with the desire of seeing this extraordinary nabob in his own house. Therefore she has, with great difficulty, prevailed on my father to accompany her. No, no, it is as I have said, Maximilian, there is no one in the world of whom I can ask help but yourself and my grandfather, who is little better than a corpse. I see that you are right, logically speaking, said Maximilian, but the gentle voice which usually has such power over me fails to convince me today. I feel the same as regards yourself, said Valentine, and I own that if you have no stronger proof to give me, I have another, replied Maximilian, but I fear you will deem it even more absurd than the first.
So much the worse, said Valentine, smiling. It is, nevertheless, conclusive to my mind. My 10 years of service have also confirmed my ideas on the subject of sudden inspirations, for I have several times owed my life to one of those mysterious impulses which directed me to move at once either to the right or to the left, in order to escape the ball which killed the comrade fighting by my side, whilst it left me unharmed. Dear Maximilian, why not attribute your escape to my constant prayers for your safety? When you are away, I no longer pray for myself, but for you. Yes, since you have known me, said Morel, smiling, but that cannot apply to the time previous to our acquaintance, Valentine. You are very provoking, and will not give me credit for anything. But let me hear this second example, which you yourself own to be absurd. Well, look through this opening, and you will see the beautiful new horse which I rode here.
Ah! "'What a beautiful creature!' cried Valentine. "'Why did you not bring it close to the gate, that I might talk to it and pat it?
"'It is, as you say, a very valuable animal,' said Maximilian. "'You know that my means are limited, and that I am what would be designated a man of moderate pretensions. "'Well, I went to a horse dealer's, where I saw this magnificent horse, which I have named Medea. "'I asked the price of it.' They told me it was 4,500 francs. I was therefore obliged to give it up, as you may imagine, but I own I went away with rather a heavy heart, for the horse had looked at me affectionately, had rubbed its head against me, and when I mounted it, had pranced in the most coquettish way imaginable, so that I was altogether fascinated with it. That same evening, some friends of mine visited me, Monsieur de Chateau-Renaud, Monsieur de Bray, and 5 or 6 other choice spirits, whom you do not know even by name. They proposed La Bouillotte. I never play, for I am not rich enough to afford to lose, nor sufficiently poor to desire to gain. But I was at my own house, you understand, so there was nothing to be done but to send for the cards, which I did. Just as they were sitting down to table, Monsieur de Monte Cristo arrived. He took his seat amongst them, they played, and I won. I am almost ashamed to say that my gains amounted to 5,000 francs. We separated at midnight. I could not defer my pleasure, so I took a cabriolet and drove to the horse dealer's. Feverish and excited, I rang at the door. The person who opened it must have taken me for a madman, for I rushed at once to the stable. Medea was standing at the rack, eating her hay. I immediately put on the saddle and bridle, to which operation she lent herself with the best grace possible. Then, putting the 4,500 francs into the hands of the astonished dealer, I proceeded to fulfil my intention of passing the night in riding in the Champs-Élysées. As I rode by the Count's house, I perceived a light in one of the windows, and fancied I saw the shadow of his figure moving behind the curtain. Now, Valentine, I firmly believe that he knew of my wish to possess this horse, and that he lost expressly to give me the means of procuring it.
My dear Maximilian, you are really too fanciful. You will not love even me long. A man who accustoms himself to live in such a world of poetry and imagination must find far too little excitement in a common, everyday sort of attachment such as ours. But they are calling me. Do you hear? Ah, Valentine, said Maximilian, give me but one finger through this opening in the grating that I may have the happiness of kissing it. Maximilian, we said we would be to each other as two voices, two shadows. As you will, Valentine. Shall you be happy if I do what you wish? Oh, yes.
Valentine mounted the bank and passed not only her finger but her whole hand through the opening. Maximilian uttered a cry of delight, and springing forward seized the hand extended towards him, and imprinted on it a fervent and impassioned kiss. The little hand was then immediately withdrawn, and the young man saw Valentine hurrying towards the house, as though she were almost terrified at her own sensations. 59. Monsieur Noirtier de Villefort. We will now relate what was happening in the house of the Procureur du Roi after the departure of Madame Danglars and her daughter, and during the time of the conversation between Maximilian and Valentine which we have just detailed. Monsieur de Villefort entered his father's room, followed by Madame de Villefort. Both of the visitors, after saluting the old man and speaking to Barois, a faithful servant who had been 25 years in his service, took their places on either side of the paralytic. Monsieur Noirtier was sitting in an armchair, which moved upon casters, in which he was wheeled into the room in the morning, and in the same way drawn out again at night. He was placed before a large glass, which reflected the whole apartment, and permitted him to see without any attempt to move, which would have been impossible, all who entered the room and everything which was going on around him. Monsieur Noirtier, although almost as immovable and helpless as a corpse, looked at the newcomers with a quick and intelligent expression, perceiving at once by their ceremonious courtesy that they were come on business of an unexpected and official character. Sight and hearing were the only senses remaining, and they appeared left like two solitary sparks to animate the miserable body which seemed fit for nothing but the grave. It was only, however, by means of one of these senses that he could reveal the thoughts and feelings which still worked in his mind, and the look by which he gave expression to this inner life resembled one of those distant lights which are sometimes seen in perspective by the benighted traveller whilst crossing some cheerless desert, apprising him that there is still one human being who, like himself, is keeping watch amidst the silence and obscurity of night. Noirtier's hair was long and white and flowed over his shoulders, whilst in his eyes, shaded by thick black lashes, was concentrated, as it often happens with any organ which is used to the exclusion of the others, all the activity, address, force, and intelligence which were formerly diffused over his whole body. Certainly, the movement of the arm, the sound of the voice, and the agility of the body were wanting, but the speaking eye sufficed for all. He commanded with it. It was the medium through which his thanks were conveyed. In short, his whole appearance produced on the mind the impression of a corpse with living eyes, and nothing could be more startling than to observe the expression of anger or joy suddenly lighting up these organs, while the rest of the rigid and marble-like features were utterly deprived of the power of participation. Three persons only could understand this language of the poor paralytic. These were Villefort, Valentine, and the old servant of whom we have already spoken. But as Villefort saw his father but seldom, and then only when absolutely obliged, and as he never took any pains to please or gratify him when he was there, all the old man's happiness was centred in his granddaughter. Valentine, by means of her love, her patience, and her devotion, had learned to read in Noirtier's look all the varied feelings which were passing in his mind. To this dumb language, which was so unintelligible to others, she answered by throwing her whole soul into the expression of the countenance, and in this manner were the conversations sustained between the blooming girl and the helpless invalid, whose body could scarcely be called a living one, but who, nevertheless, possessed a fund of knowledge and penetration, united with a will as powerful as ever, although clogged by a body rendered utterly incapable of obeying its impulses. Valentine had solved this strange problem, and was able easily to understand his thoughts and to convey her own in return. And by her untiring and devoted assiduity, it was seldom that in the ordinary transactions of everyday life she failed to anticipate the wishes of the living, thinking mind, or the wants of the almost inanimate body. As to the servant, he had, as we have said, been with his master for 25 years, therefore he knew all his habits, and it was seldom that Noirtier found it necessary to ask for anything, so prompt was he in administering to all the necessities of the invalid. Villefort did not need the help of either Valentine or the domestic in order to carry on with his father the strange conversation which he was about to begin. As we have said, he perfectly understood the old man's vocabulary, and if he did not use it more often, it was only indifference and ennui which prevented him from so doing. He therefore allowed Valentine to go into the garden, sent away Barois, and after having taken a place on the right hand of his father, whilst Madame de Villefort seated herself on the left, he addressed him thus: "I trust you will not be displeased, sir, that Valentine has not come with us, or that I dismissed Barois, for our conference will be one which could not with propriety be carried on in the presence of either. Madame de Villefort and I have a communication to make to you." Noirtier's face remained perfectly passive during this long preamble, whilst on the contrary, the eye of Vifor was endeavouring to penetrate into the inmost recesses of the old man's heart. "This communication," continued the procureur du roi, in that cold and decisive tone which seemed at once to preclude all discussion, "will, we are sure, meet with your approbation." The eye of the invalid still retained that vacancy of expression which prevented his son from obtaining any knowledge of the feelings which were passing in his mind. He listened, nothing more.
"Sir," resumed Vifor, "we are thinking of marrying Valentine."
Had the old man's face been moulded in wax, it could not have shown less emotion at this news than was now to be traced there.
"The marriage will take place in less than 3 months," said Vifor.
Noirtier's eye still retained its inanimate expression. Madame de Vifor now took her part in the conversation and added,
"We thought this news would possess an interest for you, sir, who have always entertained a great affection for Valentine. It therefore only now remains for us to tell you the name of the young man for whom she is destined. It is one of the most desirable connections which could possibly be formed. He possesses fortune, a high rank in society, and every personal qualification like to render Valentine supremely happy. His name, however, cannot be wholly unknown to you. The person to whom we allude is Monsieur France de Canel, Baron d'Epernay."
During the time that his wife was speaking, Vifor had narrowly watched the countenance of the old man. When Madame de Vifor pronounced the name of France, the pupil of Monsieur Noirtier's eye began to dilate, and his eyelids trembled with the same movement as may be perceived on the lips of an individual about to speak, and he darted a lightning glance at Madame de Vifor and his son. The procureur du roi, who knew the political hatred which had formerly existed between Monsieur Noirtier and the elder d'Epernay, well understood the agitation and anger which the announcement had produced, but feigning not to perceive either, he immediately resumed the conversation commenced by his wife.
"Sir," said he, "you are aware that Valentine is about to enter her 19th year, which renders it important that she should lose no time in forming a suitable connection. Nevertheless, you have not been forgotten in our plans, and we have fully ascertained beforehand that Valentine's future husband will consent not to live in this house, for that might not be pleasant for the young people, but that you should live with them, so that you and Valentine, who are so attached to each other, would not be separated, and you would be able to pursue exactly the same course of life which you have hitherto done, and thus, instead of losing, you will be a gainer by the change, as it will secure to you 2 children instead of 1 to watch over and comfort you."
Noirtier's look was furious. It was evident that something desperate was passing in the old man's mind, for the cry of anger and grief rose to his throat, and not being able to find vent in utterance, appeared almost to choke him, for his face and lips turned quite purple with the struggle. Vifor quietly opened a window, saying,
"It is very warm, and the heat affects Monsieur Noirtier."
He then returned to his place, but did not sit down.
"This marriage," added Madame de Vifor, "is quite agreeable to the wishes of Monsieur d'Epernay and his family. Besides, he had no relations nearer than an uncle and aunt, his mother having died at his birth, and his father having been assassinated in 1815, that is to say, when he was but 2 years old. It naturally followed that the child was permitted to choose his own pursuits, and he has, therefore, seldom acknowledged any other authority than that of his own will."
"That assassination was a mysterious affair," said Vifor, "and the perpetrators have hitherto escaped detection, although suspicion has fallen on the head of more than one person."
Noirtier made such an effort that his lips expanded into a smile.
"Now,
continued Vifor, those to whom the guilt really belongs, by whom the crime was committed, on whose heads the justice of man may probably descend here, and the certain judgment of God hereafter, would rejoice in the opportunity thus afforded of bestowing such a peace-offering as Valentine on the son of him whose life they so ruthlessly destroyed."
Noirtier had succeeded in mastering his emotion more than could have been deemed possible with such an enfeebled and shattered frame. "Yes, I understand," was the reply contained in his look, and this look expressed a feeling of strong indignation mixed with profound contempt. Vifor fully understood his father's meaning and answered by a slight shrug of the shoulders. He then motioned to his wife to take leave.
"Now, sir," said Madame de Vifor, "I must bid you farewell. Would you like me to send Edouard to you for a short time?"
It had been agreed that the old man should express his approbation by closing his eyes, his refusal by winking them several times, and if he had some desire or feeling to express, he raised them to heaven. If he wanted Valentine, he closed the right eye only, and if Barrois, the left. At Madame de Vifor's proposition, he instantly winked his eyes. Provoked by a complete refusal,